The 17th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about two blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
We're in danger as long as we continue to paint homeless people in this country as somehow other.
This year, we'll be live from the streets of Sarasota, Florida, where we'll be speaking with homeless people, and we want to hear from you. What can this country do to end homelessness?
Homeless people deserve housing, not shelters.
And we need housing that people can afford.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
That's the Homelessness Marathon broadcast.
Right here on WHFR Dearborn, Tuesday, February the 17th, 7 p.m. to 9 a.m. on Wednesday, February 18th.
WHFR, you're 30 years old? You don't even look a day over 29. Happy birthday. 30 years in and we're just getting started. WHFR Dearborn. WHFR, 30 years old. You don't even look a day over 29.
I guess that gets the point across. And thank you very much. I believe that's true with yours truly. My name is Jay Koronek. Happy to be with you for the next hour of the new WHFR Journal. This is WHFR Dearborn. And here's the theme song. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. It's our locally produced, local issue, local news talk show. Yes, once a week. Every Friday we broadcast and do the show live from 1 to 2 p.m. It's also available as a podcast, though, anytime after broadcast from this website, from our website, WHFR.fm. Just click on talk shows. And then WHFR Journal, and then select the date. And today is February the 13th, 2015. Well, I'm glad that you tuned in today. It's going to be a very, very special show. It's a holiday special. And that's because it is a special holiday today. So what is the holiday today? Again, I give you time to think about that and speak it out loud as if I could hear you. But you can't do that, of course. It's not Valentine's Day. That's tomorrow. But if you're getting a head start, okay, I'm sure your loved one will appreciate that. And if you go out tonight, remember, you might beat some of the crowds to various events, although it is a Valentine's Day weekend too, so almost any day is good to celebrate that. Well, we'll talk about Valentine's Day in a second. No, today is International World Radio Day. That's right, everywhere in the world we're celebrating radio today. How convenient. Happy birthday to radio again. Of course, radio goes back to depending who you want to talk about, either Tesla or Marconi came up with the initial idea in the 1890s. Tesla finally got the patent awarded to him, even though people have written textbooks for years for intro to telecom classes saying Marconi was the first one that did it. And it all depends on how you look at the technology he was using. But in fact, Tesla had already written a paper about how to do it, and Marconi apparently read the paper, because that's how he did it. That's how he did the first transmission of audio signal. And of course, it wasn't words. It wasn't music. That didn't come until years later when somebody figured out how to combine sounds other than just broadcasting on a frequency on and off, which is what the telegraph does over wires. Signal on, signal off, dot, dash, dot, dash, combinations worked out into be an alphabet. That's how you communicate. But World Radio Day started back in 2011, by the way. It was actually a holiday proposed and announced and created by UNESCO. That's the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And here's just a couple of facts about radio worldwide that you may not have believed, even though you must believe something's good about radio because you're listening to a radio station broadcast right now, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a stream on the internet, or whether it's over the air, as they say, transmission, no wires involved. It's still originating from an audio-only facility, and so we still call it radio here at WHFR. Well, apparently there's 2.4 billion radio receivers worldwide. How many of them work, though? And over 51,000 over-the-air broadcast radio stations worldwide. So that's pretty good. In the United States, there's about 15,000 AM and FM broadcast licensed stations out of that number. Even in developing countries. Is that the U.S.? Sometimes I think we're still developing. We've still got a long ways to go in some things, but nonetheless, in the so-called developing countries of the world, at least 75% of households have access to radio. And so if you want to pass ideas around the country quickly, and also to populations that perhaps don't know how to read so well, okay, radio can talk to them and get information out there at quite a distance. Usually terrestrial radio can go 100 miles, sometimes 150, if it's a clear channel, that is, there's no interference from any other source, and it's nighttime, radio could even go a couple thousand miles. In the olden days of radio in this country, WJR AM 760 here in Detroit could be heard all across the country, even out in the deserts of the West, the American West, at night, because the signal would bounce off the ionosphere, which pretty much doesn't exist anymore because of all those air conditioning fluids that we were using for years, like Freon gas, refrigerant too, that specific refrigerant and others that have been destroying the ionosphere. But nonetheless, since 760 was awarded a clear channel in the U.S., there was no other 760 AM anywhere in the U.S., and AM makes use of the bounce factor, whereas FM, there it doesn't bounce off of anything that I know of. Not a cloud, buildings interfere with it. Pretty much FM is straight line of sight, goes 100 miles maybe if you have a tall enough tower. But radio, AM, yeah, it can go up into the sky and bounce off the ionosphere and come down thousands of miles away. So that was... You'd always have something to listen to in the 1930s if you had a radio in your car and you're driving out west in the middle of nowhere. Comforting thought, huh? And you say, well, radio is not being successful. Well, between 2006 and 2013, when they have the numbers here, radio revenue worldwide went from $278 million to $827 million. So that's an annual growth rate of 28% a year. So worldwide, radio is growing and making a lot of money really fast. Tremendous increase. And as they point out, UNESCO points out, the younger generation around the world seems to be moving from traditional radio, though, to online radio. And we notice that here in the United States, too. I just read a major study, is that online broadcasting, live, over the air, from us to your radio antenna, your radio receiver in your car or in your house, is declining. That part is declining. But listening to podcasts is increasing. I just took a survey for WDET last week online and about my listening habits. And I realized I listen about 12 to 14 hours a day to broadcast radio without wires. And yet, I also listen to 14 hours a week, at last count or so, of podcasting. That is audio-only programming that I get over the internet or through one of my devices that I listen to. So it's already recorded shows of one sort or another that people are putting out there on the internet, and you can listen to it anytime. For example, the last hour is Democracy Now!, the new episode that they did live this morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Excuse me, 8 to 9 a.m. Every morning, Monday through Friday, Eastern Standard Time. And then it goes on to the internet at National Public Radio, for example, which is where we grab it, download it, and then play it back for you just a couple hours after their broadcast. So that's always a very exciting thing, of course, to do. And it is the current show for today, so it's only delayed 2 hours. But in a way, you're listening to something that was pre-recorded, and yet we broadcast it when we want to. If you want to listen to Democracy Now! 5 days a week, we only do it on Fridays. If you like that show and like to hear it every week, it's on their website, democracynow.org. Yeah, it's a podcast. Right after they do it live, after 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, you can go to their website and play it back. You can download the whole show and listen to it later in the day. You can subscribe so it automatically comes to your computer, in fact, or maybe your portable device, your smartphone or whatever. So radio is in these various manifestations of the audio-only medium, including, again, terrestrial broadcasting, satellite broadcasting, of course, but that's not growing as much as terrestrial broadcasting. And podcasting is very, very big, as well as listening to the live stream. And sometimes it's a combination. You're listening to the podcast via live stream from somewhere, or you could download the podcast. So it is getting bigger and bigger in the world. And just looking through that survey, realizing my own habits, I actually listen to audio-only podcasts each week more than live broadcast radio. And yet, so I'm actually listening to more audio-only, one-way communication programming than I ever did. There's a lot of great stuff out there. The Ralph Nader Radio Hour once a week. Wow, that's great. Philosophy Talk once a week. The NPR TED Show, which is edited down of those great technical, educational, and design lectures that are given several times a year around the world by the best and brightest people of the world on all kinds of topics, but they actually edit them and make a whole hour of a single topic. And that's available on iTunes Store for free. You just select that podcast along with zillions others. There's some comedy hosts that have gone to podcast. Adam Carolla, I think his name is, has one of the most popular comedy shows. And it's only a podcast, and people get it free. But, hey, gets a lot of listeners. I think he has commercials in there. I'm not sure. But probably it's the only way he could support himself. And that's really trend. A lot of famous DJs are now quitting their job at the radio station, and they're producing their own podcast, maybe every day, like Glenn Beck does this, for example, since he's not on Fox anymore. And you can go to his website, and you can get them that way. Let's see, George Norrie, who hosts Coast to Coast, which is a nationally syndicated eight-hour talk show, whatever, every night about the paranormal, UFOs, abductions, metaphysical issues, metaphysical arts, and so on, all different kinds of unusual discussions at length. And, yeah, you can get the podcast, although in that case, if you want to listen to the podcast, you have to subscribe per month. You have to pay the money in order to be authorized to listen to the podcast anytime you want to. They have an app you can listen on your phone, but again, if you're not one of those monthly subscribers, it doesn't come through. So it's just changing the way that we deliver audio programming, just like there's a different way to get your music these days and to control the music you listen to. Although you can never expect what WHFR is going to play in terms of music, because we're always programming something different that you've never heard before on other stations. Wow. So radio is a great thing. That's my little plug here today for radio. And it is International World Radio Day. and something very, very good for the whole world. It's a way to get important news, information, and entertainment out to an awful lot of people at the same time. And you can give us feedback, of course. If you're WHFR, you could write us a letter, WHFR, care of Henry Ford College, 5101 Evergreen Road, Dearborn, Michigan, 48128. If you want that address again, you can just go to our website, WHFR.fm, or just rewind the podcast and play that back. See how easy that is to do? Or you can send us an email, which might be easier to remember, WHFR at HFCC.edu. Yeah, they haven't figured out a new, since they changed the name of the college to drop the word community, not the spirit of it, but to drop the word community from the name. They haven't figured out how to give us a new URL. My personal recommendation is just let people type out henryfordcollege.edu. That's so straightforward. That should not be hard to spell. Can you spell Henry? Can you spell Ford? Can you spell college? I think that's pretty easy to do. So that'd be my recommendation. Yeah, hfc.edu is already taken by someone else. So, but we'll get there. So our email address, any questions or comments about WHFR programming, for good or ill, we take everything seriously, if we can, if it's possible. And it is WHFR at hfcc.edu. And if it's something about the journal show, just mention the WHFR journal in the subject line, and it'll get to me. Okay, Valentine's Day. Well, you know, I usually go to the internet resource of everything that everybody knows, Wikipedia. And remember, it's a free encyclopedia that it's posted by individuals, and that doesn't mean it's all true. Nonetheless, they keep adding to things and changing things. People do editing. And at this point, the Valentine's Day entry is 20 or 30 pages long, talking about history and legends and the tradition of courtly love in the Middle Ages, what was that all about, and various places in the world where they practice, how do they follow the spirit of Valentine's Day anywhere else. I think my point for today is, and that's tomorrow officially, it's a holiday observed on February 14th each year, and it's celebrated in many countries around the world, but it's not a holiday in most of them. Okay, so it's celebrated, but it's not an official holiday. St. Valentine's Day began as a liturgical celebration. One or more early Christian saints named Valentinus. Several martyrdom stories were invented. That's right. Not true. They were. I mean, it is true that they were invented for the various Valentines that belonged to February 14th and added to later stories about these martyrs. And so I'm not going to read the most famous one because guess what? They're not true. Okay? Yeah, a lot of people martyred themselves, you know, got killed because they're trying to do good things for people and or for the creation of the Christian church, the Catholic church, as it's known in one variation now. And so, you know, there was no single St. Valentine, and even the story of the more famous one, the legend of the more famous one, can't be proven true and was kept being added to over the years, and so it doesn't mean much. Now, in Geoffrey Chaucer, in the Middle Ages, or the High Middle Ages, as they called them, I guess they got high a lot, he wrote, Canterbury, Tales of Canterbury, which is a great literary classic studied often in the language of Middle English. Juan that opera with a shore of suta, drocht, or whatever. I used to have to memorize, as an English major in the olden days in college, we had to memorize the first stanza of Canterbury Tales in Middle English, in the original. Okay, anyway, that's my sad story about college. And I used to remember it, but thank goodness things fade away. Well, what happened was that Chaucer did mention this day, this Valentine's Day, connected with romantic love, although not in the way that we normally think about it, and it was kind of misinterpreted, but see, there's sort of a connection there. Again, he was writing in England, and in the 18th century England, that was 1700s, you know, when we decided to become independent and started fighting England and so on. Well, somewhere in the 18th century, it evolved in England, in Valentine's Day, into an occasion in which lovers expressed their love for each other by presenting flowers, offering confectionery, and sending greeting cards, which were known as, of course, if it was on Valentine's Day, Valentines. Okay? So we can blame all this on the English, apparently. They needed an excuse to show love to their loved ones at least once a year, and so they really thought it was a great idea to have this sort of celebration. I have said on many shows that many of these holidays that we celebrate, one way or the other, official or semi-official, or church holidays even, they should be celebrated every day of the year. I mean, we should remember our loved ones, respect them, not necessarily buy them off, give them gifts every day of the year, but do nice things for them and try to understand them and try to listen to them every day. Well, that's really tough. Well, but that's the fact. Why should it only be one day a year? And then the next day you get into an argument and you have to wait a year until you make up, I guess. That doesn't seem right. So, a lot of people, and even here at WHFR, some of our DJs are doing anti-Valentine's Day shows. That is, the downside of love. And in fact, I noticed WDET tomorrow, the Rob Reinhardt music show. And I can plug a non-commercial station in the same area because non-commercial stations are all good. That's what I think. But Rob Reiner, even on good old traditional WDET, he's doing an anti-Valentine's Day show tomorrow. So good for him. But we've been into it for quite a few years, not just because we have alternative programming, but because we think too much is made of the single day celebration. I think almost all of us would say yes to love if it was offered. But, you know, it's not something that should be a one-day affair. Well, I was looking just as a final comment. By the way, there's no direct evidence of any link between St. Valentine's Day and the rites of the ancient Roman festival Lupercalia. There's claims by many authors, but no real connection there. Now, Lupercalia, it was observed February 13th through 15th in ancient Rome. It's an archaic rite, as they call it, connected to fertility. And it was a festival local to the city of Rome. So it was only in Rome they did this. And they had a lot of fun, I guess. There's a tradition in the Middle Ages in Europe called The Art of Courtly Love. It was a book written about it, but some people think it was in jest. That is, how should a nobleman quote a fine lady? What should he do for her? He should put her up on a pedestal, not literally, but metaphorically, of course, worship her, blah, blah, blah. And I actually read the original document. Can't remember the author's name now. Again, one of those college things. And where it was all listed and itemized and prescribed, and it was all officially set up what this art of courtly love had to be about. And it was not for the poor people, of course. It's only for the people in the courts, the king and his queen and his princesses and all the noblemen and noblewomen, or ignoble men and ignoble women of their court, their circle of friends, if you were. And we think it's satire, a lot of us who read it, because it's just impossible. And but maybe fun, maybe for one day a year, I don't know. So maybe that has the Art of Courtly Love has something to do with the idea of Valentine's Day. And then lastly, I was looking at different places where I always think of people being very much in love. And, of course, there's France, City of Light, Paris, City of Love, Paris. It seems to be the case frequently in the media. But Scandinavia, okay, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, for some reason I think of them as a country that would really get into Valentine's Day, especially since it's usually so cold there in February. Got to do something to keep warm, right? Better than rubbing two sticks together. Well, they do have in Denmark and Norway, February 14th is only Valentine's Dag. It's a Valentine's Day, but it's not celebrated to a large extent. It's just imported from American culture, and some people take time to eat a romantic dinner with their partner or send a card to a secret love, ooh, or give a red rose to their loved one. So it's not a big deal, but they do have that American tradition that spread there. And Sweden is called Alla Hjärtans Dag, All Hearts Day, and was launched in the 1960s by the flower industry's commercial interests due to the influence of American culture. So they never really came up with much of their own, because I assume they're showing love to their loved ones every single day of the year. So good for them if that's the case. And again, as I said, you have to do something to keep warm in the Scandinavian winter. So I'm sure they do. United States, 190 million Valentine's Day cards are sent each year, and that doesn't include the hundreds of millions of cards school children exchange. Something to do with your hands, you know, during classes in early February, cut out hearts. I remember in kindergarten, we were told to cut out hearts by our teacher about that time of year. And a lot of kids were doing it, and then they came to me and they said, Jay, that's terrible. And I had to tell the teacher, well, you never gave me an example of what a heart shape is. I didn't know what a heart shape was. The teacher did not show us, just assumed that everybody, and a lot of the other kids did know, I was kind of embarrassed, what the traditional heart shape is. I just didn't know what it was. Big time five-year-old, you know, but we didn't have a lot of TV, you know, in those days. You can't tell what a heart shape looks like via the radio. Okay, let me just say that was my excuse. Still, interestingly, who gets the most Valentines on Valentine's Day worldwide? It's teachers. Yep, they get the majority of all cards because they force the kids to make those cards and probably give at least one of them back to the teacher. So that's kind of unfair, I guess. But you automatically get a lot of Valentine's Day cards if you're a teacher and you have that as a class project. So that's great for the teachers. They don't get enough from society, in my humble opinion. Okay, so we've gotten past two holidays, and it's almost halfway through the hour. Oh, let's see here. In the spirit of Valentine's Day, here's my favorite Valentine, which is the title of an event tonight here in Dearborn. But my favorite Valentine song, here it is. Kate Shutt, an independent artist who almost nobody knows but me. He should be very famous by now, but that just didn't happen because of the music business being how it is. Here's her version of My Funny Valentine.
Sweet coming Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable,
Kate Shutt there on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This is Jay Koronik, and the show is the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. So let's see here. It's not totally recent, but one of the podcasts I try to follow, it's new weekly, is called the Sierra Club Radio Show or Radio Podcast. It is broadcast on a station, I think, in California, but then made available from SierraClub.org and through iTunes Music Store, podcast store. And I thought it was important for all of us, as springtime is almost here. We got to believe it is, right? I know it's so cold. It's bitter cold. And there's still ice on the ground from all the snow melting. But at least we're not in Massachusetts expecting another foot of snow on top of the six we already got. So it's almost like spring here compared to them. What about Asian carp? Well, here's the story. Here's about an 11-minute segment, just the beginning of an episode, a recent episode of the Sierra Club podcast.
The following is an encore presentation of Sierra Club Radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, the director of the Sierra Club's Great Lakes program, Emily Green, will talk with us about an invasive species called Asian carp and why it's a huge risk for the Great Lakes. We'll also speak with Eugene Buchanan about his new book, Outdoor Parents, Outdoor Kids, and get some tips on greening our schools. Finally, Chef Annie Somerville from Green's Restaurant gives us some green cuisine tips for winter. Emily Green, the director of the Sierra Club's Great Lakes program, joins us today to talk with us about a problem plaguing the Midwest that many people might not even be aware of, an invasive species called the Asian carp. Welcome, Emily. It's good to have you on the show.
My pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Emily, let's start by talking about the Great Lakes in general and why they're so important to people all over the country, not just in the Midwest region.
Well, people may not know that the Great Lakes hold 20% of the world's fresh surface water, so it's actually one of the largest concentrations of fresh water available in the world, and it is drinking water and a place to live and recreate for about 40 million of us in the Great Lakes region, and also, you know, home to a major manufacturing capacity still in the region, and you know, a thriving economy. So it's really, it's important to us, and it supports, I guess, more than anything else, this just irreplaceable way of life. The Great Lakes are incredibly special to me, and I'll never forget the first time I looked out over this body of water that looked like an ocean and realized it was all fresh water, and you know, that I could drink if I wanted. And so it's an amazing place, and something we're really hoping to protect and restore.
What are some of the pollution risks to the Great Lakes today? I mean, could you actually drink it if you wanted to?
In Lake Superior, you probably could, which is the most pristine of our Great Lakes. But many of the other Great Lakes sort of hold a legacy of industrial pollution from a time before the Clean Water Act. And we still, a lot of our fish are contaminated with PCBs. And mercury contamination, of course, is a big deal for us from ongoing coal-fired power plant pollution. So we're definitely trying to ratchet that back and deal with that. But I think we've shown successfully that where we've been able to do that, the ecosystem is slowly recovering. So that's the good news.
There's a lot that we could talk about with industrial pollution in the Great Lakes, but today we wanted to talk specifically about a problem related to an invasive species called the Asian carp. I was really surprised to learn about this recently, and hoping you can start just by sharing with our listeners the basic gist of the problem with the Asian carp.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, outside of sort of the typical type of pollution you think of, invasive species are a real menace to many ecosystems in the Great Lakes in particular. Basically, these are species that do not originate here and that have no, what makes them particularly bad is when they have no natural competition or no natural predators, and they outcompete native species. The Asian carp is sort of the latest in a long list of potential invaders to the Great Lakes, but it's one that has the potential to disrupt our ecosystem and change the way we use and enjoy the Great Lakes pretty much like no other species out there.
And why is that?
Well, the term refers to several species of kind of related fish that are native to Asia, and these can grow to be monster fish. They 20 to 100 pounds, and they are what are known as filter feeders. They eat the base of the food chain, so they eat plankton, phytoplankton, and zooplankton, and they're highly, highly efficient. They can eat 20% of their weight every day. And so what that means is in areas where they establish, they eat out the bottom of the food web, so there's little, if anything else, for native species to eat. They were imported into this country mid-1900s for aquaculture purposes, and they escaped during flooding in the Mississippi River Basin and have been slowly migrating up that river system ever since. And in parts of the Mississippi and Illinois River where they have become established, they are 95% of the biomass. So they have essentially outcompeted everything else. There's no sport fish left. The commercial fishery of native fish in the Mississippi River system is gone. These fish do not have the same commercial value. And then, you know, sort of potentially even more scary, the silver carp, which is one of these related species of Asian carp, is easily startled by boat motors. So they will literally leap out of the water at the sound of a boat motor and have been known to hit motors. They've broken noses, broken bones. There was a woman on the Mississippi that was actually almost killed by getting hit by one of these fish.
So 100-pound monster fish are jumping out of the water, smacking people in the face and breaking their noses?
That's correct.
I mean, that's really unbelievable.
I know, it is. But if you Google it on YouTube, you will see videos of it. You know, the silver carp are a little bit smaller, but even then, a biologist described that he said even a 20-pound silver carp, he said getting hit by even a 20-pound carp is like being hit by a bowling ball. So, you know, and he said the amount of damage they can do to even your boat is just incredible. And so many parts of the Illinois and Mississippi River systems have basically become unusable to recreational boaters. So think no more water skiing, you know, no more jet skiing, motor boating, fishing.
Yeah, what does this mean for the angler community? I mean, what does this mean for people who want to just take their kids fishing?
Well, it's just, it doesn't happen anymore in places where the Asian carp are well established. One, because there's no fish to catch, and you can't go fishing for carp because they're filter feeders. They don't respond to bait on a hook. And then, and two, because nobody wants to boat in those areas of the water. So, to me, it's just terrifying because the Great Lakes are a huge ecosystem with a lot of very suitable habitat for the carp. In many ways, better than, they like sort of quieter waters, so parts of the Mississippi are actually flow too fast for them to really become well-established. And so, but when you look at the Great Lakes and places like Green Bay or Saginaw Bay, places where we have these big freshwater bays with flowing tributaries in them for, that are perfect for carp spawning and wetland areas that they would love to live, there's a lot of really suitable habitat around the Great Lakes, and these are the same places where people like to recreate and fish and boat. And so the prospect of them getting into the lakes, I think, is just terrible.
Now, how would they get into the lakes from the river? How likely is that, and what can be done to stop it?
Well, there are artificial connections between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River Basin system, and the most critical of these right now is the canal called the Chicago Waterway Sanitary and Sewer Canal, which connects the Mississippi River to the Great Lakes, and it was built in order for Chicago to actually send its sewage down the Mississippi instead of out into Lake Michigan, which was their drinking water supply, and this was back at the turn of the century. And so the carp right now have been found, there's been DNA evidence of the carp within 6 miles of Lake Michigan in that canal. There is a electric barrier sort of about 20 miles from the lake that is slowing, I guess, the vast push of the carp. But what we really need to do incredibly urgently is build a permanent barrier, sort of physically separate the Mississippi River from Lake Michigan.
What would that look like? Like an underwater fence or something that extends above water so they can't jump over? I mean, what kind of barrier needs to be built?
Probably something more than a fence, but, you know, what that looks like specifically is actually what the Army Corps of Engineers has been tasked to study. They've been tasked to figure out what are all the various options available to separate those two systems and prevent the carp from moving. The challenge is that they are moving with a glacial pace, I think, and they need to be moving much more quickly. I mean,
the carp are moving faster than the engineers at this point.
Exactly. You got it. The carp are not waiting for the politics, you know. So I think, and the Corps is also focusing on a variety of options that, in our view, are, they're terming them sort of risk reduction options. In our view, these are the things that we shouldn't even be considering because we need, the magnitude of this threat is such that we really need to be focusing on a permanent solution to prevent introduction and not messing around with things like, trying to use commercial fishing to decrease the pressure of entry to the Great Lakes and things that are, you know, pretty much aren't guaranteed to work. And I will say that separation does not mean necessarily that boats couldn't move back and forth or that, you know, barge traffic couldn't move back and forth. I think there are creative solutions to the existing uses of the canal that would allow those things to continue. But we need to figure out how to do that the most effective and cost-effective way possible, but in a way that permanently prevents the carp from moving into the Great Lakes.
What can our listeners who care about this issue do to help and to take action?
Well, there's a couple things. The main thing that's going on right now, the Army Corps of Engineers study, they are holding a set of hearings this month and next month around the basin and actually all the way down into New Orleans to get public comment on sort of the scope of their study, the speed, the timing. And so that's where people should be saying to the Corps of Engineers, we need you to speed this up. The study needs to be done this year, and it needs to be focused only on options that permanently prevent the carp's movement. And people can find the link to those hearings and also more information about that study and, also in a place to submit your comments online at sierraclub.org/Great Lakes.
And at the website sierraclub.org/Great Lakes, is that a place where people can also go to sign petitions on this topic?
Absolutely. We are still collecting petitions to the administration to help them put pressure on the Corps to speed up the study. And we will be continually updating that site as new opportunities, you know, emerge to sort of engage the public.
So for our listeners who care about fishing, boating, swimming, any other kind of recreating, water skiing in the Great Lakes, this is a really important time to go online to sierraclub.org/Great Lakes and take action to help protect the Great Lakes. And I'd like to add, I think this applies to our listeners all around the country, not just in the Midwest, because the Great Lakes region is just so important, and there are so many reasons to take action. So check out sierraclub.org/Great Lakes, and you can find out more.
Thanks so much, Orly.
You've been listening to Emily Green, the director of the Sierra Club's Great Lakes program. For more information.
And, if you're listening to the show, the podcast of this show, that was a podcast of Sierra Club Radio, which is available every week from sierraclub.org or iTunes Music Store, podcast store. And my name is Jay Koronek, and this is the new WHFR Journal. In the newspapers this week, local newspapers, only a couple of stories I wanted to bring your attention to. It's important to subscribe and keep hoping that someday they're going to have hire a full-time reporter for just Dearborn, not one reporter for Tri-County area or something, because we're not getting much news. And there are things happening in every individual government, individual school system, every individual neighborhood association and local nonprofit. There's a lot of stuff happening around town. And unfortunately, neither paper has the resources, they believe, to do anything. I noticed that they have a new Michigan region digital media publisher, which is the second largest owner of local newspapers in the United States. And they own the Dearborn Press and Guide, as well as many other papers around here. Jeannie Parent is her name. If you're a native, you're a native. She comes from Dearborn Heights, but apparently hasn't been back here for quite a while. She is into advertising, marketing, sales, and so on. And, of course, that's the way you make money and keep a business going. So what is the business model they have to follow? Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be, in the last couple of years, news-based, as an important news-based as I would see it. So I'm just going to have to go out on the streets myself and start digging up news, I guess, in my spare time. I don't know. But the Dearborn Press and Guide did have a couple of things that I wanted to bring to your attention, at least. And one is the passing of former Dearborn councilman Doug Thomas. He died in Florida at age 82. He hasn't been around this area since about 2009. So 5-6 years ago he left. He was well known as being anti-tax, was a proud Republican, whatever it meant in those days. But I always saw him as more an advocate for, strong participatory local government. So give the people what they want. Well, not quite that bad. Lowest common denominator and all that might happen. But when I had him on this show for several years, and this show, the new WHFR Journal, has been around almost as long as WHFR has been on the air as a public service, our weekly talk show about local news and events with people from the community. And so I had him on a couple times on this show during the years that he served on Dearborn City Council. Ran for mayor once, did not win, but I thought perhaps before meeting him, he was just sort of a gadfly. You know, he's always, whatever the mayor would say, usually Mayor Michael Guido, he would say the opposite. And he would attack. And he would try to undermine everything the mayor. Strong mayors always are the ones in this kind of government. It's called strong mayor, where they have more power than the city council. They're the ones who introduce ideas, to introduce bills, basically. And basically the job of the city council is to talk about them and approve them, maybe with a few changes. Although they could say no to some things, like the budget and so on, but it eventually doesn't work out well for them because the mayor has got all the power, pretty much all the power to keep the government going however they want. Now, that's a system we have. That's what we approved in our city charter. So Doug Thomas, I thought, was just being contrary for its own sake. But when I got him on the show, gave him a couple hours, a couple times on the show, a couple different shows for 1 hour each, I was amazed, absolutely amazed. The guy had good logical reasons for his somewhat seemingly crazy or independent views, at least, on city government. And he could well support and argue his positions. Now, you may still disagree with a person like that, but he was amazingly good at not just giving political platitudes, but giving actual specific reasons and having plans of his own for the future and better ways to do it. Unfortunately, because most everyone loves whoever the mayor is in Dearborn, the majority of people who get elected to city council are people who are endorsed by the mayor, whether it's Guido or O'Reilly or whatever, and therefore they're beholden to him, and they agree with him. So pretty much our city council just rubber stamp whatever the mayor wants, but not Doug Thomas. And I think it was important, not to be a gadfly or contrarian for its own sake, but to give the points of view full discussion and full airing. He didn't have a lot of people that liked him for that, especially not the mayors of the town. Again, he left shortly after Mayor Guido passed away, because he said for years, I'm going to stay in the city government as long as he's mayor. Because he just has too much power and he gets his way all the time, and there's too many other ideas or points of view that aren't being heard and discussed, and I'm going to keep at it. But after Mayor Guido passed, he moved within a year to Florida. Other people on the council were greatly influenced by him. Ted Tufelski, who was on the council about many of the years that Thomas was there, usually voted with him. Didn't always speak to the same issues, but when the vote came, he usually voted with Doug Thomas. And as you know, Tufelski, has almost always voted against Mayor O'Reilly, too, even when Tufelski served as the president of the city council, getting the most votes of any city council person. Now, of course, it's Susan DiBaggia, but Tufelski's still on the council. I'm not sure how he's voting these days, but the odds are he's still going against the mayor on the same sort of general principles and perhaps with the same sort of good reasoning, I hope, that Doug Thomas has had during his term in office. So a great public servant? Absolutely. Smart person? Absolutely. Did I agree with him all the time? No. But that's not the issue. I thought he should get his way every now and then. We should try the Doug Thomas approach every now and then. And he never really got much going his way to try out his ideas and theories. They say that the funeral is, of course, in Florida, but there may be some remembrance announced coming up in Dearborn. And, when we hear about that, we'll announce it. It'll be in the papers, obviously. He said that for remembrances, people should donate to the Republican Party of Michigan. Is it the same Republican Party as when he left? No, it isn't. So, but nonetheless, that was his wish, in case you wanted to know. There was a very good story on page 8A, so page 8 of section A, the first section, that was actually a little bit of investigative journalism, but not about Dearborn in particular, but some Downriver police officers actually talked to a reporter of Digital Media Incorporated about the value in wearing body cameras. And I thought that was quite amazing. First of all, is because very often police officers have gag orders from their bosses, from the police chiefs and the mayors of their city. Don't anyone talk to the press ever about anything. And send all requests to us, and we'll either talk to them or not. So they found a couple of officers down in Flat Rock that did talk to them, maybe with permission, I don't know. But still, I thought that was a very good point of view from the point of view of the officers themselves who are out there on the lines. As a techno person or a technical person or a geek or whatever, they indicated in the article that these body camera installations for each officer would cost from $400 to $800. A big price difference there. I personally can't understand that. For $400, you can get a super-duper GoPro video camera that's pretty small and really high quality. And, somebody is getting charged an extra amount of money for these smaller cameras And there's a small camera built into almost every computer these days that has pretty good resolution, let me tell you, and a little microphone next to it. And some of these computers don't cost more than $400 to $800. So I don't understand why the cops are getting stuck with a bill for $400 to $800 units that, to me, can be duplicated in the consumer marketplace for an awful lot less. But maybe they're bulletproof, you know. That might raise the cost. But take a look at that in the Dearborn Press and Guide from this Wednesday, February the 11th. Full-page story, in fact. Police officers discuss value in wearing body cameras. Okay, I thought for the sake of entertainment, whoops, we have only 6 minutes left. Well, Highway 61 with Joanne Kruczynska is going to be coming up at 2 o'clock or so. And so stay tuned for that, the Best in the Blues or Valentine's Day show today, one day ahead. Wanted to mention that there is a League of Women Voters Dearborn Heights fundraising dinner next Thursday night, February 29th, right here in Dearborn, celebrating the League of Women Voters nationally, their 95th birthday. That's a big year, huh? 95 years they've been organizing women and getting information out about candidates and elections. And that's helpful to men, too, let me tell you. And so this event is, first of all, individual tickets are $50. Tables of 10 are available for $500. For more information, and if you wanted to know, it's at 7. No, it's at 5:30 gathering. And it's at Byblos Banquets, or Byblos. It's B-Y-B-L-O-S, Banquets, 7258 Chase Road, Dearborn. And it starts with a 5:30 p.m. reception for Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, who I understand is also their speaker. She's a featured speaker there, probably after the fundraising dinner. So they're trying to raise money. And if you didn't want to go to that, tell your friends or neighbors who might be able to afford to make that donation. It'll be a great affair. We very much enjoyed Debbie Dingell on the show here when she was running for her husband's former seat in Congress, and won, of course. So she's a very intelligent, very well-versed person on many, many topics. So that should be a very interesting time to meet and greet, especially if not to just hear her speech, too. League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, their fundraising dinner next week, Thursday, February 19th, at Byblos Banquets, 7258 Chase Road, reception beginning at 5:30 p.m., and their featured speaker, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. The website, League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, is just the letters for that. So think of it, lwvddh.org. If you can only think of League of Women Voters, just search for that on the internet. You'll get the national office, then you can get to the state, and then you can get to Dearborn Heights chapter. That's where you're raising money for locally, is the Dearborn Heights chapter, I think. I think they're keeping it all locally. That's my understanding. What else is coming up here? Oh, well, of course, tonight I hope to see you out there. Well, not myself personally, but some of our WHFR staff will be there at the welcome table, welcome area, for the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra performance. Tonight, February 13th, they're having a My Funny Valentine show. If you were listening to Big Band and Beyond this morning with Joe, he had a special phone interview with Rich Ridenour and a couple of performers of tonight's event. It's a sort of a Valentine's Day special. Tickets, and it's a nonprofit, so we can plug it here like crazy. Tickets range from $15 to $30, and you can get them at the theater box office tonight. Probably appropriate to get them tonight. Special offer for patrons under the age of 34. Interesting. Two tickets for $24. So for you young people celebrating Valentine's Day one day early, either if one or the other of you, or both of you maybe, have to be under the age of 34, you can get tickets for each of you for $24 each. And again, the top price, oh no, two tickets for $24 total. Oh, well, that's really a deal. So it's a little bit less than the cheapest seats of $15 each. But they don't say where they are. So maybe they're as far back as you can go at that price. But it should be a great concert. It'll be a night of romantic favorites, pop music, as it might be called, pop classical. Music by Irving Berlin, Duke Ellington, selections from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, Somewhere in Time, the very famous movie. It's still shown over and over again. And people even have a fan club about it. It was filmed, the most popular version of it was filmed at our own Mackinac Island, of course. And Ridenour will be joined by the Sultry, and Ridenour is a dazzling pianist, according to his press release, an amusing showman. His accompaniment, Sultry singer Kathy Gibson and violinist Barry Ross. So I know he's been in Dearborn before, and everybody's had a great time. So consider that. Again, the performance starts at 8. People start gathering about 7. And WHFR is a great partner of and supporter of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra. So put that on your list. This is WHFR Dearborn. Highway 61 will be beginning in just a few minutes. Let's see if there's any catch-up information here. Jack Lessenberry, I don't have time to read the whole story, but this week in the Metro Times, he actually does the summary, again, about our bad roads in Michigan. They're not going to get better. There's a statewide election May 5th, but it's worded in such a way as to promise us a lot more than just raising sales tax and fixing the roads. It will allow an increase in the sales tax. It'll dedicate revenue for school, reverse eligible school to aid uses, blah, blah, blah. It seems that Michigan has a rule in our Constitution that any proposed constitutional amendment is supposed to have just one purpose. One purpose. And this one has about, a dozen or so. And so that's wrong. Something good in there for everybody. Yeah, well, not really. So he thinks it's a bad idea. And he does suggest this is the one way he thinks our roads and our economy can be saved, because even Republicans seem to be against this bill passing. I haven't heard anybody individually tell me, I'm going to vote for that. It is a crazily worded, bad bill. And even Republicans, especially Tea Party people, who don't want an increase in anything, even for something that's good, apparently, are against it. So, okay. He thinks that the legislature should step up right now and pass a law saying that if the sales tax is voted down in May, if that proposal is voted down,